Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Do you like cats? Do you know cats? Do you appreciate cats? Well, we've got a conversation for you coming up.
Dr. Ernie Ward is the president and the founder of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. Pet obesity prevention. Where did you get this idea to say, I need to create an organization so we have skinnier pets?
Well, Steve, first of all, I want to thank you for your efforts and your role as a board member for the Association for Pet Obesity. Because, again, your tireless efforts to improve the welfare and health of animals is so appreciated.
Thank you.
The idea came from, as a veterinarian, I began early in my career seeing more and more dogs and cats with obesity. It was that simple. And I looked around at my colleagues and nobody seemed to be concerned. Nobody was tracking it. And so I set out with a group of colleagues to say, let's try to measure this. And so we started doing prevalence surveys, you know, starting back in 2005 and 2006. And, you know, again, now we're in 2024 and we're still doing it. And, you know, what we found, no surprise, is that about 61% of U.S. cats are overweight or have obesity and about 59% of dogs. And that number just steadily keeps on increasing.
You know, when I speak at veterinary conferences and I use those numbers, and I'm not the only speaker who does, everyone uses your data. And I say 61% of cats, 59% of dogs, like you just did. But then I look out and I say, how many think that's right? And a few hands go up here and here, there. How many think that's too high? A few hands go up. How many think that's not high enough? That in fact, well over 61% of cats, over 59% of dogs are overweight or obese, and most of the hands go up.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary.
Well, and I'll tell you, it's not the fault of the veterinarian, because it is difficult to assess the body condition of dogs and cats. So there's a lot of subjective interpretation. Now, at the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, we are actively working with several very, very talented technology companies to use artificial intelligence and machine learning to give tools to pet owners and veterinarians to better and more precisely assess the body condition score. And I think it's really important, Steve, to always remind people that we're not trying to chase a number on a scale. I think we focus on weight too much. We're talking about body composition, and really that means excess body fat. The danger of being overweight or having obesity isn't the weight itself, but it's the tissue, the fat tissue, that secretes hundreds of potentially harmful chemicals, compounds, and hormones that disrupt every facet of life and lead to a lot of disease.
Okay, so in short, yes or no, do pets live a shorter life if they are overweight or obese?
Absolutely. We have research to support that. There have been two lifetime studies that showed that dogs that were kept at a lean, normal body weight lived 2 to 2.5 years. Purina did a great story. Waltham did a great study on that. Again, and these are lifetime studies. So we have a preponderance of data on this. But the story doesn't end at life expectancy, Steve. It's also with disease incidence. And so a couple of the diseases that the listeners would be interested in for dogs is arthritis. So the dogs that were kept at a lean body weight, they had almost half the amount of osteoarthritis, painful joints, that the regular weight, overweight dogs developed. And then cancer. Right? I mean, there's a strong correlation between excess body fat and cancers. They saw this in both of these studies where the dogs that were overweight or had obesity had higher incidence of cancer. So again, all that leads to shorter life, but more importantly, it's a poorer quality of life.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
For cats now, I would say epidemic is not an incorrect term. What we see as far as diabetes in cats, and it is absolutely unequivocally, is that your word?
Yeah.
Correlated to overweight or obese.
Yeah. Diabetes in cats is, as I used to call it, a foodborne disease, because, it's caused by excess body fat. Plain and simple. I mean, like, they're not genetically predisposed to this. I mean, they could be predisposed in some ways, but it's excess body fat that leads to type 2 diabetes. Plain and simple. So if you have a lean cat, they're not going to get diabetes, right? If you have a cat with obesity, they have a high likelihood of developing diabetes. And as a veterinarian, those are the cases that I find not only most challenging, but they're also the most heartbreaking, because a cat suffering from type 2 diabetes requires usually twice a day insulin injections, right? Constant monitoring of the blood glucose. And then they're going to get a host of other conditions and diseases. And that adds up to, a poor quality of life.
Yeah. And how's the cat feeling all this time?
Right.
And you didn't mention arthritis in cats.
Yeah. Right.
And you didn't mention cancer in cats, which is, so we know that all of this has an impact. On the other hand, I guess it's human nature to want to blame, but I'm not sure that we should be blaming rather than understanding. And understanding turns out to be more complicated. It's not only a matter, though absolutely an issue, eating too much. However, it doesn't stop there.
Yeah, really great point, Steve. And I don't want people to ever feel guilty if their dog or cat develops obesity, because it's a disease, right? I mean, we don't blame ourselves if our dog develops cancer, right? We don't blame ourselves if our dog develops heart disease or osteoarthritis, right? We say, oh, okay, we have to deal with it. And I want us to try to prevent disease whenever possible. So again, getting back to, like you said, Steve, you know, watching the feeding, exercising adequately, all that kind of stuff. But the reality is, you know, people need to understand that genetics play a role. You know, the endocrine or hormonal system plays a role. I mean, we know that certain drugs can play a role, right? I mean, there's so many other factors. I mean, look at the nanoplastics that we're seeing in water. Those all are what we call endocrine disruptors that lead to storing more body fat. So for me, I want people to understand this is a disease. Obesity is a disease in humans and in our companion animals. And we need to say, okay, we got to treat this disease. And what are some of the factors we can do to prevent it? Like lung cancer, right? What's the easiest way to prevent maybe lung cancer? Don't
smoke,
right?
Yeah.
So again, feed mindfully, right? So make sure you're feeding and exercising adequately. But what happens if you get lung cancer? You just start blaming everybody and say, oh gosh, you know, that's your own darn fault. No, Steve, we treat it seriously. And of course, we do everything we can to preserve quality life.
So there's something interesting that you missed, I think, and that is spay neuter, which is complicated and can be controversial. So absolutely. I would be shocked, maybe I will be, if you say we should not spay or neuter our pets ever.
Absolutely not. The spay and neuter has many, many health benefits. But like you said, it's the timing that's the real critical issue
so
here.
So talk about that, because I don't think people know, because many are afraid to talk about this, but it's a fact.
Yeah, and honestly, even many veterinarians are afraid to broach the subject because they assume people want their dog or cat spayed as quickly as possible, as early as possible.
Yes.
And so both sides of the communication, are failing. So here's the reality. We've known for the past 20 or so years that spay neuter early in life, and we're talking usually 4 to 6 months of age, downstream, further in life, can lead to a variety of conditions, okay? In fact, you know, we're looking at osteoarthritis, cartilaginous damage, so joint damage, if you will, right? And there's a host of behavioral issues that we're seeing now.
Sometimes of cancers,
absolutely. I mean, you can prevent many cancers, of course, by spay and neuter, but then there's other risk there, right? And so there's a whole, a lot of complicating factors. And so what most the science now has settled on is that you really want to wait as late as possible. Now, again, for a shelter situation, for the pet overpopulation dilemma that we're having, this catastrophe of just too many pets out there, we need to spay and neuter as early as possible. So from a shelter setting, absolutely. 8 weeks of age, fine, right?
People get those dogs too, and they're already spayed neutered, so you don't have a choice. And here's what happens when they're spayed or neutered early, either in a shelter environment really early, or what you're talking about, 4 to 6 months, which is still early enough. Then there are potential repercussions that have to do with weight.
And the metabolism, right?
Who would think that? I want to talk about that when we come back on WGN. Dr. Ernie Ward is the founder and the president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, which is the big word, right?
Right.
You know, and what can we do to prevent? And frankly, if it were that easy, I'm talking about preventing obesity in pets, you would have figured it out. If anyone would have figured it out, you would have figured it out. So it is complicated, and we're talking about spay neuter. And I am sure I'm going to get the email here, but it's an honest discussion. And to be clear, we're both for spay neuter.
Absolutely.
But what science, yes, that word science, has shown, and you can see this, it's not anyone's opinion, that metabolism changes when dogs or cats are spay neutered at a certain age.
Right. And again, if you just go back and look at why is this even an issue, why are we even talking about this, it's because the positive health impacts that sex hormones have on our development, right? So males and females out there, biologically speaking, those hormones help you develop in a normal, healthy fashion. And so if you remove those from a biological being, a dog or a cat or even a human, too early, then there are going to be potential consequences. We've mentioned that in the last segment, you know, where it could be joint problems, bone problems, even forms of cancer. So taking those hormones out of the equation too early can have those problems. Now, we mentioned that pet overpopulation is also a huge problem. So we're in a bit of a conundrum here. So shelter, you know, we totally get it. You need to have those dogs and cats spayed as early as possible so they don't go back out into the wild, into the world, and procreate and cause more of a problem. But if you have a dog or cat and you're a responsible pet owner, you know, your veterinarian is probably going to counsel you to delay having that spay or neuter till, you know, maybe closer to a year or so of life, right? Depending on the breed, the size, and so forth. And I think there's positive health. But like you mentioned, Steve, before we took the break, there's a whole population of people that get a dog or cat from a shelter. It's already been spayed or neutered, and they don't know what to feed it. And that's really been our dilemma for so long.
Or the dog or cat was spayed or neutered 4 to 6 months.
In a normal fashion,
right? It's still most common, actually, right, to have that done. So the metabolism changes,
yep,
and the bad news is that the metabolism changes. And now we have overweight and obese pets for lots of reasons, but that is one of significant. That is one that people don't talk about, actually.
Right. And it's an energy mismatch, as you're mentioning. So what happens is when they're spayed or neutered, their caloric requirements go down 20 to 30%, right? So they need less calories because they're not growing in the same way and they're not fueling their reproductive organs and so forth. And so now you take that dog or cat, spayed or neutered at 4 or 6 months, you keep feeding it the dog food, the puppy food, the kitten food, right? You keep feeding it the same amount of calories, and that's where we lead to excess fat, right? So this is where the problem begins. And so to fill that void, I mean, science has come along. They've done research and figured this out. Hey, we can actually supply those nutritional demands of growth without adding all the extra calories. And so Virbac is one of those companies that's kind of leading the charge in the research here. They've got some really interesting diets out there. So if your dog or cat is spayed or neutered at 4 to 6 months of age and you're wondering what to do until it gets to be an adult or earlier, then, you know, you need to talk to your veterinarian about the Virbac, you know, spay-neuter diets, because I think that's a very clever, you know, use of science. And so I think that that's one of those solutions.
Now, you think we're going to see more of these come along?
I do, Steve. I mean, the science is solid on this. I mean, we've known this, and empirically, you know, anecdotally, vets like myself who work in obesity, we've seen this for a long time, and now it's nice to see the science backing it up. But more importantly, products to solve it.
How about treats that will do the same?
well, again, we get back to what's in that treat, right? So if it's a high calorie, high carb, high fat, you know, the most delicious kinds of treats the dogs love and devour, then that might be a problem for that puppy or kitten, right? So we want to make sure that we're being mindful. And so honestly, in those instances, I always prefer, especially during growth phase, high protein treats, right? So you're going to have, you know, maybe the same, hopefully fewer calories, but you're at least getting protein in there to fuel that growth. And then for older dogs and cats, you know, so once they're 1 or 2, 3 years of age, then we want to start to say, can we give them like maybe fruits and veggie treats, right? So simple single ingredient treats that are lower in calories.
Yeah, absolutely true. But it's even more complicated than all of that.
Yeah.
Because part of the issue is that we love our pets so much.
We do.
And we want to feed them, and we do show love with food. That at one point in time, this was veterinarians only talked about that issue pretty much.
Right, yeah.
But that really is an issue.
Yeah, we vilified treats. I'll be the first to admit it. I think a lot of veterinarians, we kind of overreached and we made treats like the problem. That was the cause of it. And it could be, but it's probably not. It's a contributor, but it's not the end all. And removing all treats, all it really would do, in my opinion and experience, it just takes away an important aspect of the human-animal bond, right? And so for me, treating is essential. Treating is a part of the nurturing, loving environment that we strive to create for our pets. So I don't want to take away treats ever. I want to be mindful. As I mentioned, we got, you know, it might be higher protein, maybe single protein sources or vegetables and fruit types of treats. But, you know, we can be smart about it. But I don't ever want to remove treating from the equation. It's not the ultimate cause. And honestly, I think it can cause more harm than good if we take it all off the table.
So you now rule the world. Would you create treats that were healthier? They're out there.
Yeah, they're out there.
They are out there. There is even some therapeutic or prescription treats, right?
Yeah.
However, you now do rule the world. Would you have more options like that?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, that is the one thing I've really been, you know, I've been happy to see over the past decade is the fact that the treat manufacturers have realized this is a problem and it's robbing animals of life, right? And it's causing suffering. And so they've said, you know what? We're not going to just focus on the most appetizing most delicious. I mean, we're still going to make good taste and stuff, but we're also going to say, can we do this in a fashion that also provides nutrition? So again, you don't have to take the good taste off the table, but you can replace it with something that provides some nutritional benefit.
So the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention has always been about figuring out, okay, how many pets are actually overweight or obese? But now there's a next step.
Yeah. So the awareness and the prevention aspect, all that stuff, you know, we're continuing to work hard on. But we're really looking now as an organization to help promote and develop and encourage treatment. Because this is a big problem, Steve. It's not going away.
Well, obesity is a disease,
as you
point out.
It is a disease. Yeah, and we now have to make sure that we are out there marching soundly behind the drumbeat of saying we need treatments, we need help. And you know, I'm also emboldened by when you see all the GLP-1s, the Wegovys, the Ozempics of the world, and the positive impacts they're having on millions of people around the country, helping them lose weight and get back to a healthy lifestyle. You know, I'm encouraged that we're going to start to see, you know, not anytime soon, but those types of therapeutics enter into the veterinary space over time. Again, I think that what it's really doing is it's making people aware that obesity is a disease, there are treatments available, and that, you know what, when we get to the other side of this, life's a lot better.
Yeah. And life is a lot better because of the quality. We don't have time to talk about this, though I love talking about this, because for obese animals, they can't be dogs. They can't be cats.
No.
I mean, the cat can barely jump on the sofa to snuggle with you. You're lucky if that cat uses the litter box and steps into it because it is so obese. Dogs don't get to be dogs outdoors because it hurts too much, perhaps, to really run around. So it impacts quality of life in a huge way.
It does. And again, you mentioned all the ambulatory and the abilities to physically interact with the world. But Steve, it even gets worse than that. And we know from human studies and even animal studies that the changes in the brain, right, the neurochemical changes that go along with excess body fat lead to depression, right? Lead to animals and people just not feeling great about anything. And again, I think that when people say, well, why do you choose to fight this fight about pet obesity? It's really to improve quality of life. And so it's physical, it's mental, it's spiritual. And you know what? We can help with all of that.
There he goes, Dr. Ernie Ward. As always, great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
So I was scanning the internet and I saw a video of this. I want to share with you what happened in this video from Italy. This poor dog, I mean, trying so hard. Happy dog, wiggly tail, no tragic story here, don't worry. And this dog just simply wanted to play fetch and kept dropping the tennis ball right at the feet of this individual. And nothing happened. The tennis ball was not thrown. And the dog kept trying. You know how dogs sometimes run the other way in anticipation? You're going to throw the ball that way. And they go running. And the dog did that. And no ball. It just sat there. The dog barked, woof, 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 at the dog. And the dog is trying so hard. Just wants to have the ball tossed. That's all. And then the dog still didn't realize why it wasn't happening. I did. It was a statue of a person who never did throw the ball. How sad.
It is the only nonprofit, I think, like it on the planet, Jackie Acciacola, who is the executive director of the Every Cat Health Foundation. Am I right about that?
Yes, Steve Dale, and you are board secretary of Every Cat Health Foundation, and we are all about bettering the lives of every cat, every day, everywhere in the world, and we've been around 55 years solely focused on cat health research.
Well, that's the thing. So I don't think there's another nonprofit. There are some that fund dogs and cats and horses and wild animals. There are a couple that fund dogs, which is all great, but I don't think there's another that only exists to fund cat health studies.
Not that our breadth is international, it's everywhere, so not that we're aware of. We are the only one.
But for 55 years, as you point out. And I think that if you have a cat, if you've ever seen a cat, if you've ever known a cat, pretty much everything about those cats was once funded by us that we know.
Probably so. And I have three cats, and I know at least several things have touched all of them.
Yeah. So anytime your cat goes into a veterinarian for an exam, vaccines, it doesn't much matter. No matter what your veterinarian does for your cat was once funded by us, it seems.
This is true. And we even provide education programs for folks so that they themselves can maybe have a little less anxiety about taking their cat to the vet even. So all kinds of things from behavior to vaccines to just diagnosing and even treating some diseases that cats face. We've been behind all of that.
So there's exciting news around the corner about feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the most common heart disease in cats. We'll be talking a lot more about this on this radio show, but it turns out it looks like there's going to be a magic pill, actually, which is something we've been looking for a very long time. And the people that manufacture that magic pill told me, well, we wouldn't have been able to do this without the basic knowledge about the disease that no one really understood until you guys, meaning the Every Cat Health Foundation, funded many studies to kind of figure all this out.
The research is so important. It's how we gain knowledge about the disease in the first place, and we rely on the researchers, but we also rely on donors to help fund that research. That's
Absolutely.
How we get the support to do what we do, and then in turn, pharmaceutical companies, pet food companies can take that information and develop that miracle pill.
Yeah, in this case. Diabetes is an example. So diabetes is sadly very common in cats. Veterinary professionals years ago actually had it backwards as to how cats then first get diabetes and then what to do about it. Now that isn't the case. A good friend, Dr. Deb Greco, who was then at Colorado State University, is the one this organization funded years ago. And it turned out, yeah, she happened to be right about what her thinking was about this. So now we think about and we understand diabetes in cats, and we really didn't for many years. As just another example, a more recent example that you can talk about is FIP, or feline infectious peritonitis.
And you have a much longer history with our organization on FIP, but yes, something that once was thought to be fatal.
Yeah,
but
it's not treated. Yeah,
But yes, now we have help in recognizing that and treating that due to research that we funded 30 some years ago. And just to take a leap of faith into exploring something that was unknown, but why are these cats dying?
And so many cats, mostly kittens with FIP, were dying and continued to until very recently. When an antiviral and then another antiviral, and now it's been replicated around the world because we know the magic pathway to treat a disease again. It took, you mentioned, 30 some odd years to even understand this very complicated disease, which at first was thought to be a retrovirus. It wasn't, and on and on and on. But now we understand it, which in of itself is huge, you know? So many kittens were dying of FIP, it's not happening anymore.
That is huge. So it's the research and the exploration and then also the education piece that is so very important.
Yeah, so the research is done, but if people don't know about it, whether they be veterinary professionals or cat parents, which include cat breeders, which is a great deal of the history of this organization.
Yes, we were born over 55 years ago from the Cat Fanciers Association. The breeders in that group were very concerned about the health of the animals that they were breeding and took an interest in cat health, and were so fortunate as a world that they did.
Yes, well, yes, absolutely true. And a lady by the name of Joan Miller was the one who helped begin this organization, who just recently passed away, and she said even early on, you know, this can't just be for purebred or pedigree cats, it has to be for all cats. And it really has been. Another area of investigation recently has been kidney disease, and there may be solutions coming around the corner, actually. Again, this organization has had, and you know what, feline or cat specialty veterinarians know this. I don't know that all cat parents do, and I don't even know that all veterinarians do.
Yeah, so for so many years, I think cats took a back seat to dogs, and I also give a home to dogs. I love two of them at home, but so much focus was on the dogs. So just to help elevate the knowledge and the research that we have around cats, and Joan Miller also had an affinity to support researchers, and yes. We have a new investigator award named after Joan Miller to help those folks in the field that are newly new researchers.
Well, that's an important point because we have a board member, for example, who's a member of the Canine Health Foundation, great organization who we work with. They have a lot of money to spend. Somehow, cats don't get that money. So, friends, think about it, because if you have a cat, care about cats, this is an organization you might want to support.
Absolutely. And you can check out our website at everycat.org. There's opportunities there to sign up for our webinars, which are free.
Free?
The webinars are free.
Favorite word.
And they're very enjoyable as well. You can learn a lot no matter how you're associated with a cat. There is much to be learned. Also, researchers can find information about our grants process on everycat.org. And you can also find out about our upcoming symposium.
And there's a free, I like that word again, newsletter also that you could sign up for. Oh, you said upcoming symposium. So when we come back, we're going to hear more about that. Now, this is something veterinary professionals are attending. Here's what's cool. You can too, virtually or in person. And we'll tell you about that after this on WGN. Every Cat Health Foundation Executive Director is Jackie Acciacola, and you just mentioned a symposium. So this organization's mission is to fund cat health studies, but also to educate. So every couple of years, there's a major symposium that's held. And when I mean major, I mean people from around the world, even before the pandemic, and no one was doing virtual. Well, this organization was doing virtual and had people watching in real time all over the world, even if it was in the middle of the night where they happen to live.
Absolutely. Our education programs are extremely popular. We are solely cat focused. I believe, just for example, our last webinar, we had over 25 countries tuned in and watching. But our symposium coming up, you can participate live, virtually or live in person, and it will be available recorded if you register as well. And the name of that symposium is Being Perfectly Clear on Feline Pain. We are focused this year on pain.
And when is the event?
April 13th and 14th.
At
North Carolina State University School of Veterinary Medicine.
They have a feline health center, and their dean came to me and said, you know what, why don't we do something together? And we were chatting, what would the topic be? And by the way, you can attend virtually this program. You don't have to go to Raleigh, North Carolina, but you can. But the thing is that we were talking, and we said, what would be a hot, important topic in feline medicine? And for a couple of reasons, we thought about pain in cats. One reason is they have, at their university right there, two of the top experts on the planet. And we're bringing in a third as well, who's the president of the International Veterinary Academy of Pain Management. So that's Dr. Tammy Grubb is her name. So if you were to hold something and say, we want on feline pain, the three greatest people on the planet, these are the three you would choose, I think.
It's sure to be a great program. All topics all related to cats and pain really run the gamut, and there's so much to know, and there's so much to learn, and there's also so much to learn about your cat and how it communicates with you about that pain.
Well, that's another thing. So surprisingly, cats, even more so than dogs, they don't tell us when they're in pain.
Yeah, I have a mama cat, Lola, and she's at least, well, she's more than 13. Her kittens are 13 years old, and mama cat's slowing down a bit. And I've had to work with my veterinarian to kind of learn, well, what does that mean, and what are we looking for? And yeah, she's got arthritis. I do too. So how do we manage that? What kind of lifestyle changes need to happen, but all to manage her pain?
It's all those horses you ride, I think. But cats actually, it turns out they have arthritis, osteoarthritis, much more than veterinarians ever previously thought. But it's not only arthritis. You mentioned other kinds. So it's ocular pain. It's GI pain. It's pain related to cancers. I mean, the list is actually quite long that will be covered here.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, just like you and I possibly can wake up with aches and pains, the cats do too. They're just not telling us.
Right.
So we, you know, just help when in diagnosis and treatment, and there are more options coming out all the time for treatment.
And we're going to hear, we're going to hear about some of those new options as well. And nutrition is a part of all of this as well. How can that be?
For sure, just like in people.
But how can that be? I mean, we feed our cats. Well, you're going to hear the answers to all of those things. And incidentally, yes, some of the new treatments as well, acceptable treatments, but newer treatments that you might not know about. Veterinary professionals will be there. If you're a veterinary professional, you can still sign up and get what are called continuing education credits.
Absolutely. The courses will be race approved. So again, check us out on everycat.org and information will pop up right away.
Or if you're just a cat lover and have, as you explain, you must have apparently three cats. If that's the case, then you might want to attend as well. And you can for like, what, $25 or something?
General attendees are $25. And Steve, you really don't have to have any cats. You can just be curious about cats or just love cats or just want to learn. And you are welcome to participate.
All right. Well, you could do so either in person or virtually, correct?
Absolutely.
Now, I mentioned the newsletter earlier. Tell me about the Every Cat Health Foundation newsletter and why, if you are a cat lover, you might be interested. And it doesn't cost anything.
No, our e-newsletter is free. Again, you can find out about how to sign up for that on our website. But we have a monthly newsletter, articles on what's new with cats, what's new with the research we've funded, opportunities we have coming up as far as education goes. And we also have a blossoming volunteer program. So if you're able to help convey our message and information about our research and are interested in cats, we may have opportunities for you to be involved.
Cool. You love your veterinarian?
I love my veterinarian.
How do we know that?
We have programs participating with veterinary clinics as well. You can honor your veterinarian through a donation to Every Cat, and we send them a certificate and a thank you.
And they put it up on their wall?
Or your veterinary technician. I hope they put it up on their wall.
I do too.
And we also have remembrances for your cat, or if you are a veterinarian, your client's cats. I know, actually, even Steve Dale, when my dog passed away, you made a donation to Every Cat Health Foundation in remembrance of my pup. So very, very much appreciated.
Well, and that's a nice thing to do, you know, for other people, because people think all the time, my neighbor, my friend, my son, daughter, whatever, their cat passed away, and I want to do something special for them. Well, this is a way to do something special that will touch their hearts, that will actually help all cats.
Yes, everywhere, every day.
Yeah, and that's what this organization does. So tell me one more time what the website is for the Every Cat Health Foundation.
It's easy. It's everycat.org.
There she is. She's easy. Jackie Acciacola, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve Dale.
I don't know why that's so funny. Hey, I also want to answer an email question. You can email Steve at stevedale.tv. Dear Steve, my cat stopped covering his number two in the box. It's stinky. It's from Glenda in, where is Glenda from? Glenda's in Highland Park. Glenda, there's lots of reasons for the cat stopping to cover her business in the box. You know, you didn't mention the cat's age, and I will tell you, and I've talked about this before on the radio many times, but never enough. So many of our cats are arthritic. We don't know that necessarily, and there are so many signs of the cat is hurting. And one of those signs sometimes is the reluctance to cover up everything in the box. Now, if the cat never did that, I will get to that. But if the cat always did cover its
stuff in the box. That could be an explanation. It could also be that your cat is overweight or obese. Then it is difficult, or overweight, obese, or arthritic, all three of them. So that might be the explanation right there. And by the way, a visit to the veterinarian might be a good idea. In fact, it is a good idea if this is a new behavior. If it's always been this way, there are a couple of possibilities. First of all, there may not be enough litter in the box. The cat may not love the particular litter, but is tolerating it, and therefore I'm doing my business and I'm getting the heck out of there. It could be there are other cats in the household and that is intimidating to this cat. Maybe not enough litter box choices. And therefore, oh my gosh, I've got to get the heck out of Dodge before another cat may come into the litter box. Or it might just be an idiosyncratic behavior. Some individual cats just say, hey, I don't care. I don't need to cover this stuff up so much. So it depends on all of those possibilities I spoke about. It's been talked about for a long time whether secondhand smoke is a problem for our pets. Before I go there, I want to talk about what we know for sure, and that's for pet parrots, that any kind of smoke is potentially a death sentence, believe it or not. So that includes cigarette, cigar smoke, but it also includes you may be burning something. You're making bacon in the morning and you're cooking it way too long and the fumes smell good to us, but can actually be very harmful, if not life-threatening, to a pet bird. Potpourri. I mean, all of these things are problems for parrots. But let me talk about dogs and cats. There's some new studies out, and including the information from this one new study in cats, it notes that inhalation of the smoke could be a problem. I'm talking about secondhand cigarette smoke. But what we know, according to the study, is a problem is cats groom themselves. Well, that's not news, but what is news here is that smoke, or the tar and nicotine from the smoke, has stuck to the cat's hair. And the carcinogens are now being ingested by the cat. And according to the study published in PubVet, it turns out to be really very, very dangerous. And in fact, lymphoma is more likely to happen, among other issues, for cats. Now, in dogs, it turns out that you can go to work, be with people that smoke, not necessarily in the workplace, I hope, anymore, but just be with people who smoke at their house or whatever, come home, and the dog is kind of doing the same thing as that cat, in a sense, and is just sniffing where you were on your trousers, and can actually ingest similarly, by sense of smell, the carcinogens the same way. So yes, bottom line, secondhand smoke is a problem. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.